Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. On today's show, we're turning to the silver screen for a look at what's on at the cinemas. And talking us through some of the titles opening today is the film critic Karen Krizanovich. We'll be discussing the Spanish family melodrama Julieta, music industry spoof Popstar, and the dystopian thriller The Purge: Election Years. Karen, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's always lovely to be here.
Now, we'll start things off today with the Spanish film Julieta, which I think needs to be first because it is by far my favourite on the list for today. It, of course, gained quite a bit of attention when it was playing in competition at Cannes for the Palme d'Or. Maybe, Karen, set the story up for us.
Well, Julieta is another of Almodovar's look at the feminine. I mean, most of his films sort of circle around that. It's the story told in flashbacks of a young woman who, well, there are two different women. A woman who's looking back on her life with her estrangement with her daughter. Now, that's a bit of a spoiler, but it is about the dissolving of a relationship and the coalescing of a relationship between mother and daughter.
It's quite, I referenced that in the introduction there, that it's a melodrama. To me, it felt so much like a soap opera, and I say that in the best possible way. I know a lot of Almodovar's films do feel like soap operas. He's very good at that. And I find it so amazing that they get the reception that they do, because it almost looks, when you watch one of his films, especially Julieta, it feels as though it's the kind of film that so few people would really understand for being self-consciously soapy and melodramatic. And yet, it just hits a nerve with so many people.
It does. I think people love Almodovar because, I mean, this is his 20th feature. And we've grown up, like Woody Allen in a way, that we love him for every single one of his steps, however successful they might be at the box office or otherwise. He specializes in making a heightened kind of Douglas Sirk movie. These are melodramas, and they're very much focused on the complexity of female relationships and also of mistakes, of one single error or a series of decisions that didn't work out the way they were planned to work out. And I think Julieta is an example of that. But another reason we like Almodovar is because his design and his use of color is so strong. And the visuals are very, very strong. And it's easy to understand. Even if you don't speak Spanish, you can see the beauty and the drama that plays out.
The cast of this film, I thought, were especially beautiful. Everyone just fits in so perfectly. And, of course, you do have Rossi De Palma popping up yet again, Almodovar's muse. There's actually an interview, of course, with her on The Cinema Show, which you can catch at 20:00 on Friday here in London. She's just one of the many cast in this film that really fit together perfectly. The actress that plays the younger version of the main protagonist, I thought, fit that role just perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely, beautifully. And what's interesting is well, actually, I thought the older woman was amazing as well. But this, how do you handle a flashback so it's believable? How do you handle a younger character and an older character? And I think Almodovar does it beautifully by this casting. And you can see, actually, in the face that even though she's still beautiful, you can see that the stresses of her life have taken a toll.
How do you think it fits in with some of his other films? Because I know when we were in Cannes and Pedro Almodovar was appearing on some of the panels, and a question was put to him about why he decided to put his film in competition, and he referenced that was an intentional choice. He wanted to be in Cannes, and he wanted his film to play as part of the competition. And I know that there are a lot of people who saw the film as quite a bit of fun, but not necessarily on the same level as some of the other maybe more serious minded films that were aiming for the Palme d'Or. Of course, Ken Loach eventually ended up taking it away. American Honey thought it might grab the prize as well. How do you think it sort of fits in with some of his prior films? Because, I mean, it would be tempting for some to maybe look at Almodovar and say that he's not necessarily a serious filmmaker. He makes films that are a lot of fun.
Oh, I don't think you can say he's not a serious filmmaker.
I completely agree. Yeah, but are some of the criticisms, yeah, especially from his arch nemesis, the film critic for the El País newspaper.
Well, it's nice to have enemies, isn't it? As long as they don't kill you, it's nice. I think that Almodovar is he started out his career with the movidas of the short films and these crazy sort of transsexual sexual tension and fun. I mean, really, after Franco died, he wanted to have fun, and he wanted Spain, particularly Madrid, to have fun, and so we had these crazy comedies, much as Woody Allen's career started. And then he moved more into melodrama, and he goes back and forth from melodrama to comedy. And so I think it fits in quite well. And in fact, I'd heard that he was planning a comedy for his next film. So I think he has a love, as most people that love comedy, has a love of serious topics. And this is a very serious topic, is the breach between parent and child.
Well, that is Julieta. It's out today here in the United Kingdom and Ireland. But if you're in the US, you'll have to wait until December. Well, that's bad luck. But of course, over in the US, they got a Cafe Society much earlier than we did. So really not that bad. They're spoiled for choice anyway. And of course, don't forget to catch my interview with Rossi De Palma up on The Cinema Show. That's at 20:00 here in London. Karen, let's move on. Changing pace completely. We have pop star, Never Stop, Never Stopping. That's the title of this film. So it's the latest flick by Lonely Island's Andy Samberg, which has been produced by Judd Apatow. Now, straight away from that combination of names behind the film, Karen, we can imagine it's going to be a rather silly look at the life of a pop star. We'll jump into that head first in just a moment. First, though, here's a clip.
Connor's second album drops today.
Out of four possible stars, Rolling Stone has given it the shit emoji. So, mixed. Let's call it mixed reviews.
Well, that there is a clip from Popstar, starring Andy Samberg as a failing pop star called Connor For Real. Four, of course, there is the number four. Karen? This film, clearly a self-conscious stab at the online world of YouTube pop stars, perhaps, just judging by Connor For Real.
It's actually, the first half of this film is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. If you have followed any boy band at all, in any, I don't care how old you are, this is a combination of like Spinal Tap and Zoolander amped into boy bands. And yes, there's a lot of social media involved, and a lot of, you know, it's a real digital culture, but the writing of this is so knowing, and it really does take off the fact that there's, you know, when you have a trio, there's always one that does better than the others. And the other ones go off, as in the case of this, one of them goes off and lives on a farm, but he's very bad at farming. And the other one stays on and sort of becomes a lackey to the Connor For Real, who tries to be modest and can't be, because if you're a pop star, you can't be modest. Not really. You can say you're modest.
You can give the careful illusion of being
modest. He has somebody that gives him drugs and also somebody that hides his drugs. So he has all these different people on his payroll. It's hilarious. He's got 15 different people on his payroll. And it just reminded me of like Kid Creole used to pay somebody to tie his shoes. But I mean, it's what you want your pop stars to be. And it's all about the smoothing over of rough edges, the lying to yourself, and this fanatic way of trying to keep yourself hip, trying to keep in the eye of the storm with your fans.
A lot of people, I think, tend to think that part of keeping yourself hip is to promote a certain image. So beyond, far, far beyond whatever you are obviously supposed to be famous for, Kanye West maybe being a decent example of this. You can be out there as a musician of some kind, but really people will keep talking about you because you are perceived to be so eccentric and so bizarre that you'll keep your name in the headlines simply for being a ridiculous person.
Well, absolutely, you can do that. That's a negative way. Nobody wants a good a good musician. Just stay home. No, you want somebody that's going to do something like Connor For Real does. I mean, his best friend's a turtle, so he says. And he hasn't. This is a spoiler alert. He has. He does these wacky costume changes that they say that only women can do because men's apparently genitalia get in the way. I didn't know. So he tucked. I'm sorry. This is TMI, but he tucks everything behind him, and then, of course...
Oh, like a drag queen.
Like a drag queen. And, of course, everybody sees him on stage looking like that, so now they think he doesn't have genitalia. So that puts him in the spotlight yet again. So all this sort of crazy...
Needs to do a Lenny Kravitz.
Exactly. He does. You see, if there's so much like this, and the only problem with this film is that in the middle, he does a change of heart and becomes a good guy. Which is a disappointment. But see, because the first half of this film, I was laughing so hard.
How much of an indictment is it then on the current celebrity culture? Because
huge indictment.
That's what you want. I mean, if you look at the way people become famous now and seem to maintain their worlds of fans, you've got completely different worlds now. And obviously that is because you've got the multitude of different mediums that you can be famous on. You can be Instagram famous, YouTube famous, Tumblr famous, and then
there's silos of fame. Yeah.
Normal famous, perhaps. You know, if you still happen to be appearing in the supermarket tabloids, Fergie, perhaps. You can be famous for all these different reasons and have completely different worlds of fans.
Yeah, absolutely right. And the Adam Sandberg's character is an old-fashioned famous guy. So he's across platforms, but they're very aware. And in fact, there was one bit where they've decided to promote this bad album by putting Maya Rudolph was playing a character called Deborah. And he says, "Where's that name come from?" "I think it's from Deborah. What do you think?" But they put all of his music into household appliances, and it drives everybody crazy. There's a lot of nuance in here, and it's hilarious. And I would say, please go and see it because I think it's really funny.
Well, there you go. Pop Star Never Stopping. That's such a confusing title. I keep looking at that.
It's based
on
the Justin Bieber.
Of course it is. Yeah. Of course it is. Well, look, I'll say it again. Popstar Never Stop, Never Stopping is out now in the United Kingdom and Australia. A lot better than that bizarre name might suggest. Karen, we have one more film to discuss today, and that takes us down a rather darker path, if you can possibly imagine. The Purge, Election Year. Now, this is the third and final film in the Purge series, which takes a look at a dystopian America where there is a 12-hour slot each year where all laws are lifted and anyone can commit any crimes they like, the idea being to cleanse the rage of the country. recall some of the election promises from a particular candidate. Karen, where did we leave off last time and where do you think this sequel is taking us?
Well, the sequel, say election year, and I got all excited thinking, it's going to be about the election. They're going to have a Donald Trump character in there. You know, I don't know what I was thinking. But it's a franchise of three films. So how is it doing? This one is good, don't get me wrong, but it's not as good as the other two, which is, means it's probably losing its losing its purge a little bit. But it's a dystopian future where the American government has decreed that one night a year you can kill anybody you want, basically. Now, this is really nice for the filmmakers, which are written and directed by James DeMonaco, where, we know that danger and murder is actually entertaining, at least on the big screen. We've been fed it long enough. So this is a way of sort of saying, we've got violence, we know it's bad, but we're still going to enjoy it. So that's what we're doing. Now, the Purge election year takes place in Washington, D.C. Again, it's ritualized chaos during a free election, which is strange. It is a little odd. I can't say now, I'm not a fan of horror movies, but the reason I wanted to talk about this was I think that horror movies have moved from sort of being the date movies where you want somebody, the attractive person you're out with, to grab you because they're frightened or to be grossed out. I think that horror movies are really starting to move, and this has probably been going on for a while, but it's becoming a little bit more obvious. They're moving into more serious adult commentary. And this is a real commentary about American politics, the way the world's going at the minute. And I think it's actually kind of important. I mean, for example, Babadook, which I think was a year or 2 years ago, somebody was saying, well, that's actually an analogy for depression. So I think that horror movies are not only just this sort of fun where we can have guilty pleasure by watching, people being killed by other people, basically, but also I think they are quite a good way of commenting on the political state of affairs.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the best films that we've seen over the years, horror and otherwise, are really very, very clever allegories for some of the bigger issues that we're facing in the world today. Just looking specifically at The Purge just for a minute, is it just me or does the mere concept of this film strike you as a little bit, like, overtly silly? I mean, in what sort of world would we ever have a setting where laws are completely lifted temporarily so anyone can commit any crime? We were just talking about how some of the better horror films are, you know, clever and can construct allegories for real life things. That strikes me as just completely stupid.
Well, it's along, in a way, it's along Hunger Games lines, where society has decided that this is a good moral release. That's the excuse for this, that they've determined that society is going to be better for this one day every year. And of course, it's a bit silly. But then you think, well, you know, what would happen if I was allowed to do anything I wanted one day of the year? I wouldn't leave the house.
I would absolutely stay home.
Stay in, yeah. Well, that's what most people do in The Purge. But hopefully they will go out and see The Purge election year along with The Purge. And actually, you should see all three because they are interesting and they do have the pitfalls that most horror movies have. For example, you know there's a lot of telegraphing like, oh, there's a security breach. Ooh. You know, of course there has to be because otherwise nothing happens. But they are actually slightly more inventive than your typical run-of-the-mill horror movie.
Just a regular Saturday at home then. That's The Purge election year out now in cinemas around the world. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Thanks to Karen Krasenovich. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time on Monday when we'll be taking a look at New York's art scene. But for now, goodbye from me. Thanks for listening.